BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Hello, I'm Lauren Laverne, and this is the Desert Island Discs podcast. Every week, I ask my guests to choose the 8 tracks, book, and luxury they'd want to take with them if they were cast away to a desert island. This is an extended version of the original Radio 4 broadcast, and for rights reasons, the music is shorter than the original broadcast. I hope you enjoy listening. My castaway this week is the chef Tom Kerridge, proud owner of 3 pubs, a catering business, 1 London restaurant and a hat-trick of Michelin stars. He's the first chef to win a pair for his Marlowe pub, The Hand and Flowers, as well as being a familiar face on Foodie TV. He got an unlikely start in the kitchen, rustling up Findus crispy pancakes and beans on toast for his little brother while his mother was at work. But it was walking into a hotel kitchen at 18 that changed everything. He says, you fall in love with the people, the environment, the space. The guys in the kitchen were very similar to the naughty kids I went to school with. I was very lucky that I walked in somewhere and knew that would be my life. Not bad going, considering he was only there to do the washing up. His kitchen door may bear the legend, danger, do not enter, pirates with knives and fire, but perhaps he's mellowing a little bit. These days, the culinary rock and roll excesses have gone on the back burner as he's made changes to his lifestyle that helped him lose an astonishing 12 stones in weight and learn to love the gym. Very useful when it comes to keeping up with his young son. And as an added bonus, his weight loss cookbooks have become bestsellers too. Tom Kerridge, welcome to Desert Island Discs.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, it's a pleasure. So you have, so to speak, got a lot on your plate. How on earth do you manage to fit in training now on top of the demands of your career and family life?
As a chef, you kind of forego a lot of sleep. So I've always been quite good at getting up in the mornings, like powering through, walking up the road with your eyes closed or making a cup of tea or all of that stuff from early doors in a kitchen. I've always been quite good at powering on with very little sleep. And I kind of have the same ethos to it now.
You opened your first establishment back in 2005 with your wife, Beth, who is a sculptor. She took some time off to work on that project with you. How did you find working together?
Well, we still do, to a point. The first year was pretty difficult, I got to be honest. Like, as a husband
and wife,
it's
amazing.
You're laughing, I want to know why. Yeah, yeah. Because it's bumpy, you know, you spend time with each other and it's amazing as a husband and wife, but you then spend time with each other as a head chef and a restaurant manager. Finding that balance between being a work relationship and a husband and wife relationship is very difficult, and sometimes it spills over that you end up having an argument over the pass about something that no one else in the team needs to hear you arguing about. And I have to be honest, I owe everything to Beth. She gave up her career for a number of years. You know, she went to the Royal College of Art. She worked as a technician for Sarantini Caro for nearly 10 years. She then went, okay, well, listen, I'll give you 3 years and we'll open the pub. And the idea was for me to cook and for Beth to make uncompromised art. And well, The Hand of Flowers is nearly 14 years old. And further down the line, she's had the commission for the opening of the front of the Dubai Opera House, a massive 5-metre marble piece. She's had sellout shows in London. She's, you know, she's an established artist in the art world now, which is amazing. So, but you have to drive forward and believe in yourself and stick by each other, even through the rough times.
Let's dive into the music. And I think this is an artist that you've actually fed.
It's an Oasis track. Liam, he wanted a table for a Sunday lunch and we couldn't get him in for about 8 months. So he waited about 8 months to get in and then came in for Sunday lunch and he was booked in at 1:30 and he turned up at 11:30 and started on the espresso martinis at 11:30 and just continued all the way through lunch. And I'll remember it for the rest of my life. It was just one of the best moments ever. Like, we were hung out for about 20 minutes chatting. And I said, do you want to come in the kitchen and say hello to the boys? He was like, yeah, 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 yeah. And by this point, it was the end of the meal. He kept his parka on throughout the whole meal, like eating Sunday lunch with it completely zipped up.
Never less than 100% Liam Gallagher.
No, and he moonwalked into the kitchen. And you can imagine these bunch of like 15 chefs just thinking, what on earth is going on here? And Slide Away is the track that I've chosen from definitely, maybe for me, arguably the best debut album ever. And this is a track that I used to put on when I used to get in late at night, about 1:30, on repeat, and I would fall asleep, listen to it, and it'd be on all through the night. So Slide Away is my first track.
Yeah.
Oasis and Slide Away. Tom Kerridge, some chefs play around with molecular gastronomy and dry ice and describe themselves as artists, but you describe cooking as a trade. Who's right, I wonder?
Well, everybody's right. But for me, it is like a trade. Like, I'm a builder, I'm a carpenter. I've learnt the building block. Like, you lay a foundation. I understand, you know, there's flavour foundations, the process of cooking, the understanding of how to cut and cook different cuts of meat, an understanding of salt and savoury and acidity levels. They're all just building blocks in creating a dish, which is like building a house. But you learn it as a trade, and you can look at a house and go, that's amazing. And that's kind of like how we build dishes together.
So you have that kind of practical, you know, breaking it down into its constituent parts, and that is reflected in your creative process and the way that you approach putting food together.
It is, yeah.
And in an industry that is not exactly known for its job security, I mean, how precarious have things been for you in, you know, right back to the early days? You know, have you ever had that kind of sense of security?
Even now, I'm terrified that every day no one's going to turn up. Like, you know, we're fully booked in places and it's busy and it's good. But I'm terrified the phone stops ringing or something's not going to happen. And I think that's probably the same for every restaurant. You know, in those early years, you know, 2008, when that first recession hit, there was a period where we were very much struggling as a business across the board. But I think the one thing that you do, you can, as a smaller owner operator, you can make decisions and you can, you have to attack each situation. You can't just let back and let the business world as it is swamp you and swallow you up. You have to fight back and attack it. So we made a decision as a husband and wife on one day that we're going to put a £10 set lunch on. That's it. Set is 10 quid. We'll get bums on seats. It doesn't matter. We'll keep it feeling alive and active. And there were periods in that when I was doing 48-hour shifts pretty much. So on a Friday morning, I'd get up and get into the kitchen at around about 6:30 and we'd work all the way through to the end of a Friday night, clean down the kitchen, finish up by midnight. And then I'd start making loaves of bread. And we would do a pop-up bakery the next morning. So I would bake throughout the night, all Friday night. And then Beth would come in on the Saturday morning and we'd do a pop-up bakery and sell. It was probably about 200 loaves of bread I'd make overnight. But then I would go straight back in for lunch service on Saturday morning. I would be there and go through all the way to the end of Saturday night and then go home and go to sleep, probably via the pub, and then have a kip. So it would be from Friday night through the way to Saturday morning. We'd do that every week for a while.
How long's a while? I mean, how long can you do that for before you fall over?
It was a number of months that we would do that. But when it's your business, those are the sort of things you have to commit to. And I'm sure there's so many people that can understand and relate to that, that when you run a business and you've invested everything you've got no pension scheme, you've got no savings, you've got nothing. The only thing that you have is this business that you don't even own the freehold of the pub. You just got to go, right, I own this business to make it work. I've got the only person that can do this is me. So you just have to commit to it. You just got to go double-footed tackle straight in there and keep going with it. And that's it. You just got to keep pushing on.
Time for some music, Tom Kerridge. Tell me about your second disc today. Why have you chosen this one?
It's a Beatles track. Kind of my first experience of music. My dad was a big Beatles fan. And it is one of my earliest memories of sitting on a sofa with big earphones on, like proper clumpy old school ones. Me and my brother with those connecting it into this cassette player. And listen to Here Comes the Sun. And it's quite weird because I don't really have many dad memories, but relating it to the Beatles and music, this is kind of one of the things that makes me think of him and a childhood.
Here comes the sun, here comes the sun, I say it's all right.
The Beatles and Here Comes the Sun. Tom Kerridge, take me back then to your family kitchen when you were growing up in Gloucester. Who cooked there?
Well, it's quite a weird space, really. We grew up eventually as a single parent family. My mum and dad split up when I was 11. But before that, there wasn't really a mum and dad relationship either. I suppose the best way of describing it is my dad wasn't exactly the best role model as a father.
Okay.
Because as a small child, he wasn't always there. And then as we got older and into teen years, he was very, very ill. So it was unrecognisable. So my mum took up the reins as a single parent, hugely. She would go to rugby training with us and then cook Sunday lunch for all the rugby team that would turn up back at the house. And, you know, and she was like this amazing woman that worked two jobs, thoroughly wanted the best for her kids, you know, me and my brother. We never lacked in love, but our food, she would work again in the evenings. So my first experience of cooking was cooking Findus crispy pancakes or doing fish finger sandwiches or pot noodles or doing stuff for myself and my brother as tea. And then once a week, we would do spaghetti bolognese. And I learned to cook the kind of ragu sauce with my mum. And the special thing about making it the day before you actually eating it. And you hear so many times that it tastes better if you allow it to mature. And I don't know if my mum knew that or whether it was a mistake or whether it was something that... But it's something that it tasted better the next day. So we'd always make it like on a Wednesday to eat on a Thursday. So Thursday we always knew was spaghetti bolognese day. And then on a Sunday, my mum always used to make a point of, even if there was no money there, like we wouldn't have a joint of meat. She would quite often get, it was like a sausage meat packet from one of the supermarkets that she would roast that as the joint, but we'd still have the vegetables, the cabbage, the carrots, the broccoli, the roast potatoes, the bits, you know, the things that me and my brother would argue over who has the crispiest potato. And that was such a joy for me because I didn't recognise it as being, oh, we can't afford a rib of beef. It was just like, yeah, it's the sausage meat thing. And it was lush. It was key to it always, the hospitality. My mum always welcomed so many people, so many kids, like proper naughty boys that we went to school with would turn up with late at night with a black eye or something like, and my mum would always welcome them in no matter what, make sure that they had a cup of tea, do they want something to eat, is it all right, can she phone the parents, all that sort. Like it was always about, there was never a moment of no one being welcome in the house. So that terms of hospitality, of people being welcome and making people feel that they want to sit down and put the telly on or do what, like that was always key. And that's probably the biggest thing that I've learned, not food, about warmth and hospitality and love that my mum gave and still hugely gives to everybody that she lives nearby and locally with now.
Tell me about your next piece of music, Tom Kerridge.
It's a track from by Michael Jackson. For me, it was my first real live gig. And I remember queuing up overnight with my mate Neil to get tickets to go and see Michael Jackson perform at Cardiff Arms Park. So we were 16. And it was the first real experience of such an amazing and incredible, not just musician, but showman. The show itself was just absolutely jaw-dropping. And he was such an entertainer and such a superstar. And I have to be honest, I do feel a little awkward when I talk about Michael Jackson and Michael Jackson tracks because of all the negative publicity that goes alongside him. But the track is Don't Stop Till You Get Enough.
Grooving in the studio here to Don't Stop Till You Get Enough, Michael Jackson. Tom Kerridge, what sort of teenager were you when you were growing up?
I was never the naughtiest boy in the class, although I did go to an all-boys comprehensive school in the middle of like three estates. So, I mean, to be the naughtiest boy in that, you'd have to be like real special. You're like on a proper world-class naughty level. I didn't hate school. In fact, it was quite the opposite. I quite enjoyed school because it was hanging around with your mates and being friends and doing whatever else. But school really didn't connect with me in terms of academically. I'm much more of a practical doer. I came away with four GCSEs, which I'm quite proud of. I was never going to go on and do A-levels and go and do a degree, that's for certain.
Did you see yourself as talented? Did you think you had potential?
No, but I was never worried about what I was going to do. So my mum never made us make life decisions, never said to me, you've got to do this. She said, whatever you do, just make sure you do it the best you can. And I've always felt confident that I would do something with my life, but I had no idea what it was, and I was just waiting for it to turn up.
On your mum, though, I do believe that she described a period after you left school as your DOS years.
Yeah, no,
quite keen for you to talk me through those.
Yeah, between the ages of 16 and 18, I kind of didn't do very much at all. Like there was a YTS scheme that I was kind of part on and then didn't really go. And then there was a thing, I did a little bit of acting. I think from being a youngster and being involved in a youth theatre or being involved, it's really good for confidence building. It's the same as being in a sports team. You do stuff, and you to be able to stand on a stage and say things and do things. So I ended up just going to this youth theatre and being involved in it, and I really quite enjoyed it. And it was in Cheltenham. So two lads, I went with, again, my best mate Neil, I went to Michael Jackson concert with. We went to a youth theatre, and, you know, that's full of lovely girls from Cheltenham's Ladies College, and we were two blokes from an estate in Gloucester. It was kind of like, you know, it was a good place to be. I think it was good fun. Like, I ended up filming the Christmas special of Miss Marple, and then I ended up being...
I'm going to ask you what you were playing in the...
I played a ball stall boy. It was set in a ball stall, so I was like some, like, ball stall kid in Miss Marple. But that was quite cool, because I look back at that and go, yeah, so actually I hung out with Joan Hickson, you know, like the woman that you think is, that's Miss Marple. Like, I look back at that and go, yeah, I spent a couple of weeks hanging out with her filming, like, when I was 16 or 17. And then I went on to, I filmed two lots of different kids' TV shows, I think, for ITV, where both of them I played a bully in, like a school bully. And then London's Burning was the last thing I think I did, London's Burning. I was, my official title as the credits go up was Thug One, Tom Gerridge.
too much of a theme developing at that point.
I was like, that's it, I'm typecast, that's it, I can't do this anymore. I mean, it was all good fun, like, but it wasn't really what I wanted to be.
But given the amount of drive that you obviously exhibit day to day and that you've had to have to get to where you are now, what do you make of that kind of period where you were drifting to some extent?
I suppose if it went on any longer, over the age of like 18, and you'd start to worry. I could imagine as a parent, you'd start thinking, listen, you really got to pull your socks up and do something here, because this is getting like a bit of a joke. I knew something would happen somewhere. I was just trying to find the right thing. And then when I went in and washed up and started cooking, it suddenly became, oh my God, this is it. The beautiful thing about the hospitality industry is it's never about money, because if it's about the money, you're in the wrong job. Like, it's about, you're just in a space that you love and you thoroughly, the left field way of life, the rock and roll style of it, everything that's a part of it, it suddenly becomes quite, it's a very cool thing. I mean, it's such a wonderful industry. You can travel the world, you meet so many different people, you can cook on so many different levels, and it's such an amazing industry. And I was so lucky to find it, or it found me.
For now, let's go to the music. What's your fourth disc today, Tom?
For me, one of the most underrated bands, I think, ever, and it's Placebo and their track Black Eyed. And it's, I went to see him a couple of years ago in Brighton, and the people that went to go and watch Placebo, they're kind of, it almost felt like they connect to people that are social misfits. They don't always feel that they're the same as everybody else. We're not in the same box as everyone. But then when they were all together, everyone was the same. It was socially connected, and it was amazing. It was wonderful. And then to see Placebo play live, for me, is the best live band I have ever seen. The drums in this track, Black Eyed, are amazing. And also there's a few lyrics about coming from a broken home and how it connects. I mean, it slightly feels a little bit loose cannon-ish, and I'm not that much of a loose cannon, but I do connect to the lyrics in this song very much.
I was never faithful, and I was never one to trust. Borderline in schizo, and guaranteed to cause a fuss. I was never loyal, except to my own pleasure, so forever black-eyed, a product of a broken home.
Black-eyed by Placebo. So tell me then about finding your niche. You enrolled on a catering college course, as well as working in a Michelin star hotel. How quickly did you realise that, you know, you'd found the right path, the right place for yourself?
Once you get over the initial, my God, I'm tired, my feet hurt moments. And they're weird, because some days they can be long, 15, 16-hour days, sometimes more. But then the end of it, that one beer with your bunch of chef mates that might only be 15 minutes and a cigarette out the back, it makes it all so special. It makes it worth it. It makes the whole thing, the adrenaline of getting through the day, to get to the other end is just fantastic. And it was just like, it really did capture my heart. And I like the pain of it. I like the graft of it.
Who were your role models during this time? I mean, you know, nowadays TV schedules are awash with cookery programmes, including your own, of course. There's plenty of you know, great chefs for young people to look up to. But what about you?
I look at Delia Smith. Okay, because she's like the greatest. My mum had Delia Smith cookbooks, and you go, I mean, she's just phenomenal. And a Delia Smith cookbook that my mum had grease marks on it and flour and little notes in it and things like that. And I want my cookbooks to be the same. But then I suppose the real crossover, the first, I think, proper chef that made it big on TV that connected with people but cooked lovely food was Gary Rhodes. And I worked for Gary for a period as well, which I thoroughly, thoroughly enjoyed. But I think that probably the biggest influence is a chef that I've never worked for, and that's Marco Pia White. When I was 18, he released a book called White Heat. And this book came out with all these vibrant pictures of the kitchen being alive and active and chaotic and fun and vibrant. And there's lots of quotes by brilliant French chefs telling you how amazing Marco Pia White is. And all of a sudden, British chefs connected to this guy, this British chef from Yorkshire, who was cooking this amazing food. And this book was so, so special. Without that book, there wouldn't be half as many chefs my age cooking, because Marco suddenly connected to people. And he was the first real rock and roll chef. You know, he would throw people out of his restaurant. He would do, but if asking for salt and pepper, rumoured stories, you know, there was all this kind of, it was a little bit like there was no Twitter and no internet, no, like these kind of rumoured stories would appear. And Marco was probably one of the biggest influences.
Time for some more music. Tell me about your fifth disc today. Why have you chosen this?
It's The Prodigy, and the track I'm going to choose is Everybody in the Place. And they've been a band that I've listened to from early career, you know, 17, 18, all the way through to now. And then again, I've been very fortunate to cook for them. And it was actually Keith's birthday.
So Keith, for the benefit of Radio 4 listeners, that's the one with the hair.
Still has the hair. It was a table of eight. Three of the guys that were eating were vegan. So Keith had a vegan birthday cake. And you just think, yeah, this is The Prodigy. If you think of everything that they've done over their years, they're now sat having a vegan birthday cake whilst the boys in the kitchen are singing them happy birthday to Keith from The Prodigy.
Who still has his double mojito going either side of his head.
When they walked into the restaurant, the actual fire alarm was going off as The Prodigy were
as
walking.
The Twisted Fire Starters.
Yeah, you couldn't write it, could you? We had a chat for a bit. He's got all my cookery books. He was talking about the recipes that he's cooking. I'm like, oh my God, Keith's cooking for my cookery. I hope he's got like little marks in it of what he's done differently, like a Delia Smith cookbook for Keith. He used to be a butcher before he broke through in The Prodigy. He was a butcher. So this connection was like,
it all comes together.
Yeah, it all came together and it was amazing. So them coming in, and then, so for me, Prodigy, Everybody in the Place. This is a real motivator. It's one if you're on a breakfast shift. No one wants a chilled out song in the morning. You want this. This wakes you up and gets you cooking breakfast. Let's go!
Prodigy and Everybody in the Place. Tom Kerridge, people who've seen you on TV will know that you've lost an incredible amount of weight during the last 3 years. I think in chef terms, it is 12 stone, which is an entire Jason Atherton.
Yeah, I've lost Jason Atherton.
I mean, what was the trigger point in deciding that you were going to make some changes and lose some weight?
Age. It got to a point where I was 39, approaching 40th birthday, and for listeners that aren't there yet and everyone who has reached it and gone beyond it, it is a point of reflection. You do sit back and you think, okay, what have I achieved? Where am I at? What's going on? What am I doing? To then go in, how do I want to live the next 40 years? And I wasn't going to unless I made a change. And that was very apparent, that epiphany moment, I suppose, of going, I need to do something here to move forward with it. There wasn't a health issue that arose. It was just a point of going, I've got to do something here. And I measured it on feeling healthier, jeans getting looser, throwing clothes in the bin, doing more, walking up the steps without getting out of breath. All of those sort of things were my measurable things rather than it being measured on an amount that I wanted to lose. Because I still don't know what weight I should be, really what weight I am, where I'm going. I just want and needed to be different.
Having lost so much, what feels different to you? You mentioned being able to walk up the stairs, you know, your clothes feeling looser, but then you must feel substantially different.
Yeah, hugely. Well, and exercise is big. So I started off by swimming, and I would swim a mile, and I'd swim it really slowly, and I wouldn't give up. And it's a big step to get into a swimming pool being that big, like being conscious of your body and worrying about, like, it's not just going to the gym where you've got clothes on. You're just walking around in your pants, essentially.
But how interesting that you chose that.
Yeah.
You chose like the hardest version of the, you know, the thing that's the scariest.
Well, that was another reason. So if I'm going to do it, well, I'll tackle it head on and I'll do this and I'll walk through a change room and get into a swimming pool and I won't look or care or listen. Swimming's very good because you become isolated. No one can talk to you. Your phone doesn't ring. There isn't a space that you're on your own. And I quite liked entering a space on my own because my life has got to a point where I'm never on my own. There's always somebody who needs something somewhere regarding business or like anything. And that's like, I'm really happy with that. But swimming was quite good because all of a sudden it gave me a space to think through a new dish or a different thing. And swimming became quite important. That has changed slightly because I've become more conscious of being able to get into the gym. So the gym has now become quite a big thing.
Let's go to our next track. Tell me about your sixth disc today. Why have you chosen this?
This is actually a very difficult song for me in terms of a time of my life and what it represents. So the lead up to losing weight, when I stopped losing weight, I also stopped drinking. And alcohol had got a grip is probably the best way of describing it. I have completely destroyed alcohol for myself. I am untrustworthy with it. I got to a point where I was drinking huge amounts every night, never during the day, always after service, but it was colossal amounts. I would say still am dependent on alcohol. So I haven't touched it for 6 years. It makes me feel very uncomfortable and not being around it. And this is where I suppose being running pubs, I've been able to remove myself from it as it's now part of the business that I offer, not my personal life. So I sell it and I'm proud to sell the best beers and great wines and fantastic gins and whiskies. But I don't touch it. I can't touch it. I'm untrustworthy with it. There is no stopping me when I have one. I don't understand a drink at all. I don't get a beer. Like for me, it's like nobody has just a little bit of something. The purpose of it is to get smashed in drunk. And I have no enjoyment in the understanding of having a single drink. So John Bramwell is a singer-songwriter from the band called I Am Clute. He's also fairly open with his chaotic musician-like lifestyle. He sings about it a lot. And this track, for me, hugely connects to me. It's the most beautiful record I think ever written. It's very special. It relates to alcohol. It relates to a slightly dysfunctional relationship with it, with other people. The most amazing thing about Clute is that they're one of the only bands that Beth allows into her studio. Like she'll have music. Most of the time she has Radio 4, obviously. But other times she will have bands. She doesn't let many bands infiltrate her studio when she's working, but Clute are one of them. And it's a very special band. It's a very special song. And it does make me feel like it's the most wonderful track. But every time I hear it, it makes me feel almost sick in my stomach that it relates to a period where I am freely admitting that I have an issue with a substance.
Hey, could you stand another drink? I'm better when I don't think. Seems to get me through. And say, do you want to spin another line? Like we had a good time. Not that I need proof. Well, we're living in a hotel. Someone's ringing my bell. The room without a view. And hey,
I Am Clute and Proof. So, Tom Kerridge, a track that you love, but one that is painful to hear because it mirrors an experience that you've had.
Yeah, not just an experience, a whole period in my life. And it's really weird because I find it difficult to because I don't regret that period at all. Alcohol became a huge release for driving a business forward, to winning two Michelin stars, to creating a space, to building this platform that we have for everything, for all the staff and the people. And it always proved this massive release of energy, of pressure.
And there's the work hard, play hard mentality, which is one thing.
Yeah.
But how do you know when you've gone beyond that and you've strayed into territory where, you know, this is a problem?
Okay, you know you've gone beyond that when you drive around in the boot of your car with a case of beer and a bottle of gin, just in case you're working somewhere that night and the bar is closed by the time you get there.
That's something you did.
Yeah. Yeah, that is a point where you go, okay, if I at the end of wherever I am, I might be away cooking somewhere, I might be filming, I might be doing something. If it gets to a point where I go back to the hotel and the bar's closed, I had pretty much a sleepless night the night before, knowing that I'd go away, thinking that I won't be able to get a drink at that point.
Who did you talk to?
No one. No one at that point. Everyone knew. Like, I'm in an industry full of play hard, party hard, rock and roll chefs, that big awards dues, big drinkers, big people. I would always be last man standing at every awards due and then go on to something else. Come on, let's go find some more. Let's go do it. Let's like driving it on all the time. So industry wise, everybody knew that I was a big drinker. At home, staff wise, everybody knew I was a big drinker. At the end of service, I would order like a pint of Negroni, you know, and that would be like a start of it. It wasn't something that I hid. Again, it's one of those things that I will do things excessively. If you want to drink and party hard, then I will be the best at this, and I will drink more than everybody and anybody else. And clearly that was a huge amount to do with the weight gain, and also obviously helped in weight loss when I stopped. I look back at it and I don't regret a single minute of it, but I do feel massively uncomfortable thinking of that person. And every now and then I miss that guy. I miss the chaos. I miss the fun, and I regret that I can't ever do that just once, because I can't. And I know I can't be that person. There was an example, and it must have been about 4.5 years ago, and it was a Saturday night, and I finished working at the Hand of Flowers, and I went into a local pub, met Beth. I said, come on, it's a Saturday night, it's 9:30, I'm gonna sneak off early, let's go. So I took her out for a drink. She had a glass of wine, and I ordered a bottle of non-alcoholic beer, and I'd done 8 bottles of them in 20 minutes. It was frightening and it was horrible. So I said to her, oh, we have to go home now.
How did you cut out your drinking?
Stopped. I worked it out for myself when I stopped. I just went cold turkey one day. That was it. But that was a 3-month process to working up to it. I let it in a little bit at the beginning because I said to Beth, I won't drink unless we go to a live band. And we go and see Clute. We went to see him play in Bristol, and it went pear-shaped. It went back to the hotel and I started ordering sherry and port. And it was just... And I woke up the next morning and I just went, it's ended. That's it. There's no more. I can't do this. It just cannot exist in my life. I would like to think that maybe one day I could enjoy a glass of red wine with the roast beef that I love so much. But at this moment in time, there's no way that's allowed in my life.
And you don't worry about that anymore. You feel comfortable talking about it.
No, I do worry about it. I worry about it all the time. And it's weird when you find yourself in a position like this. I never thought of leaving school that I'd find myself on Desert Island Disc talking about Oasis and Clute, and then talking about a problem with alcohol, and going, actually, when you are that person that we have a voice that is now on the radio, or you are on the television. And the reason why I went through the weight loss thing and then wrote the book, the first book, was this is my journey. And if it helps one person lose weight and get onto a different lifestyle that they want deep down, then it's worth doing. The same as being able to talk about alcohol in a position that actually, if you can approach it with the right mindset, you can do this.
Let's have some more music. Tell me about your 7th disc today.
One of my favourite bands ever, and it's a band called The Rifles. They played at my 40th, which was pretty much the last time I drank. I mean, my 40th birthday was, I have to be honest, it was quite special. I shared it with Daniel Clifford, 2 Michelin star chef. So we hired a big barn in Marlow. We had about 250, nearly 300 people there. We had 10 barbecues there. We had pretty much every Michelin star chef in the country cooking. The Rifles came and played live, and then Danny Ramplin finished it off with the DJ set up until the early hours. The bar, I stocked it thinking, right,
I'm going to drink again tonight. This is it. It's my 40th. I'm just going to let go now for once. And I start the bar. We had to go out and refill it three times because there was 250 chefs there. I forgot that they all were capable of what I used to be capable of. And I was very fortunate that they allowed us to use this track for my first solo TV show on BBC Two, which was the proper pub food show. They let us use this track as the title music. So they've got so many good tunes, but this one is quite special to me because it comes from the TV show. So it's called Tangled Up in Love.
I can't find the perfect word to say. How could I define when nothing could relate this feeling? There's so many words, but nothing hits the mark. The child has returned in my heart. And when you come
Tangled Up in Love, the Rifles. Tom Kerridge, what advice would you give to listeners who are aspiring chefs that want to run their own place like you do?
Being a chef isn't actually about food. Being a chef is about organization structure, being able to cope with the orders coming in. Then it is about the food. You can teach anybody to cook. That's a skill set and a trade. The rest of it is about organization and making sure that you're ready to go for it. And if anybody is out there that wants to get into the world of cooking, just do it.
You have, of course, a career that sees you surrounded by people, looking after them, making them happy. I wonder how you will cope with the solitude that is going to greet you on our desert island. It's going to be very quiet.
I know. I think I might enjoy it for like a day. And then I'll be so bored. I'd end up talking to myself. You know, like Tom Hanks in Castaway when he created Wilson. Mm. Like I'd have to make a Wilson.
I'd have to have a fake.
I'd probably have three or four fake friends. Hello. Hello.
Are you practical? Could you build yourself a shelter?
Yeah, I'd have a go at everything. I have to be honest. So our house is slightly the reverse. So Beth can MIG and TIG weld. She's a sculptor. She works with metal and bronze casting, and she's got all the tools that any builder would be jealous of. Like, she is the most practical person there. I do the cooking, but I am not scared of having to go at anything. So whether I'd actually be any good at it is Beth would say, no, he's rubbish.
One more track to play for you before you go, though.
It's The National, which is it's an American band from Ohio, and it's called Fake Empire. And it's because I feel that I'm in a fake empire. Like, isn't it all a blag? Like, I'm a guy from Gloucester that didn't do very well at school, that just found a job that I like doing, and just I've just said yes to everything and just gone, yeah, let's do it, let's do it, let's do that, let's do this. And then before you know it, you're 45 years old and there's like 250 members of staff and you've got Michelin stars. And I'm like, how on earth am I here? And I'm so proud of everything that on a personal level that I've achieved, but on a team building level, I'm so proud of everybody that they're so special that they've created this space that has huge foundations. But I'm like everybody, I think, that does all right in business. There's a bit of you that is terrified it's all going to collapse and fall apart. And I'm waiting for somebody to tap me on the shoulder and go, all right, mate, listen, your time's up. You've blagged this for long enough.
Found you out.
Yeah, that's it.
Come on.
You have other two Michelin star chefs that walk around with their chests out and wear chef's jackets and are like, yes, look at me. And I'm almost apologising for it. It's like, I'm not really sure it's
We've
us.
Been on Desert Island Discs now. Yeah. This is another string to the bow. Come on, when's it going to sink in?
Yeah, well, that's it. This is another one of those moments I'm going, Are they sure they wanted me? And like, I'll be walking up, I'm pretty sure it was
definitely
Gordon Ramsay they were after.
It was definitely you that you booked. But we do want to hear The National, so let's play it.
Stay out super late tonight, picking apples, making pies, put a little something in our lemonade, and take it with us, put life away in a fake empire. We're half awake in a fake empire. Tiptoe through our shiny city with our diamonds.
The National and Fake Empire. So I'm sending you away with three books, The Bible, The Complete Works of Shakespeare, and you can take one of your own choosing. What's it going to be?
it's very difficult for me, right? Because I was going to choose the Michelin Guide 2012 when we won 2 stars, right? But I have to be honest, there ain't much else to read in it. But I'm not going to take it. I'm going to take the Marco Pierre White White Heat cookbook, but the 25-year edition, because second to winning 2 Michelin stars, one of the proudest moments of my career is being asked by Marco to write a piece for the re-edition of the after 25 years. So I'm so proud of that. So that I'm going to take Marco Pierre White's White Heat, the 25-year anniversary.
You could also have a luxury, something to make your time on the island a bit more bearable.
I am a bit of a man of routine and I have to shave my head every day. So I will be taking a razor sharp shaving kit so I can shave my head every day.
Are we talking just like, you know, bristle brush and razor blades, that kind of thing?
It will be in a bag, but it will have the shaving gel and half disposable razors, like the handle that you clip off the other bits. Yeah.
Okay.
So, and then it has a moisturising cream and an oil that goes on the top. So that's the routine every day to shave my head.
It goes in one bag.
I can't just have like a razor blade because I'd end up with a rash and it'd be horrible. And then I'd have to stop cutting my hair. And if I did that, what would happen? It only grows at the side. So I'd end up, when I finally get rescued, I look like Krusty the Clown from The Simpsons. Can't have that.
So the shaving kit will be yours. And finally, which one of these 8 discs today would you save above the others?
Because it's so prominent and because when I hear it, it almost makes me want to cry, and because it was from a special part of my life, and also because I think it's one of the most beautiful records ever written, I am going to take I Am Clute and Proof.
Tom Kerridge, thank you very much for lending us here your Desert Island Discs.
Thanks so much for having me.
Hi, I really hope you enjoyed that interview with Tom Kerridge. You'll have heard him refer to Delia Smith and memories of his mum's well-used and fairly splattered Delia cookbooks. Well, she was Roy Plumley's castaway in 1982. We've cast away many chefs over the years, including Ruth Rogers, Nigella Lawson and Gordon Ramsay. And I can confirm that Marco Pierre White did indeed ask people to leave his restaurants on occasions. Here he is talking to Sue Lawley back in 1991.
Shall we deal with the reputation first, Marco? When are you rude to your customers and why?
I don't believe I'm rude to my customers. I believe my customers are rude to me. And that's why I politely ask them to leave my restaurant. I don't like people who click fingers. I don't like people who mimic my French staff or have laughs at their expense, especially when they're working long days. They should be just left be. And what a lot of people don't realise is enjoyment in a restaurant is a two-way street. They have got to come in to the restaurant and sit down and enjoy themselves, and they've got to give off niceness, and they've got to be polite with my staff and show affection. And if they do that, then they get it back. If they come in and they're rude and abrupt and short, they don't wish to be served by them.
So what do you do? Just march out and say, excuse me, would you...
No, not necessarily. No, they've got to be very rude now. Nowadays, I just bite the leather and I sort of tell my manager. And we've both grown together because my manager was only 19 when he joined me. And I was 25. I mean, we were very young boys. And he could barely speak English and I could barely cook. And, you know, I mean, we just did not do a very good job. I mean, it was like faulty towers, but...
So this image that you have of being a sort of talented young man who can't be bothered to control his temper because his success has gone to his head...
But people who condemn me as being a talented young man who can't control his temper are people who obviously don't know me. I expect results. And if somebody makes a mistake in my establishment, then... I do shout at them, because at the end of the day, it's my name above the door, and if the customer writes a letter of complaint, then it's to me and not to the young person concerned.
Marco Pierre White talking to Sue Lawley. All those programmes are available to download. Next time, my guest will be singer and songwriter Gary Barlow. I do hope you'll join us.
Hi, I'm Monty. Sorry for interrupting your podcast. Just give me a minute. I've got something I think you'll really love. It's called Life Lessons. This is a podcast from BBC Radio 4. It's going to be full of the issues that are important now, and we'll hear about them from people who really know what they're talking about, because these issues are at the centre of their lives. We'll be hearing about period poverty from campaigner Amica George, Questioning the Food We Eat from farmer Kate Moore, The Brexit Divide from vlogger Jazza John, and many, many more. Young UK talk about the issues that matter most to them. They're living it, so we can learn from it. Subscribe to the Life Lessons podcast. Discover it now in BBC Sounds.